We'll continue the interview with Mrs. Ramsey. Mrs. Ramsey, I think we can get on to your activities on the Planned Parenthood Board.
Well, the people tell me it takes a generation for an idea to bear fruit, but I can remember, I've been married for 35 years, and before I was married, I worked for Planned Parenthood in Philadelphia. It's been more than a generation, and I guess you can say it's taking hold, but it isn't taking hold enough to suit me when there are 5 million women in the United States who want family planning service, and only about 1 million of them are getting it. Of course, Planned Parenthood has always been emphasized, every child a wanted child, and they have not embraced the concept of zero population growth, which is would require not more than 2 children per family to stabilize the population. I personally subscribe to the tenets of zero population growth, but I continue to work for family planning because I am anxious to see every child a wanted child, even though I realize that this will not solve the population problem. There are too many people that want 3 children or 4 children or 5 children, and not to mention these leading families of America that I believe are families, have an organization composed of people with more than 6 children, and they preen themselves with delight over the fact that they're contributing so much to the population. I think that lately I've been working on the League of Women Voters Committee on pollution, air pollution, water pollution, solid waste pollution. All of these are things that are going to engulf us. We're stuck on this planet. It's impossible to the idea that people are going to be able to emigrate to space, that there are frontiers the way there were in this country, is ridiculous. Also, it's equally ridiculous for people to say that there's plenty of open land in this country. Yes, there's open land in this country. Most of it is not very agriculturally advantageous. But even if it were, even if we could accommodate a larger population, and a much larger population, the fact of the matter is that the other countries of the world, in Latin America and in Asia, are so horribly overpopulated that we are trying to maintain an island of affluence in a sea of misery, and this is impossible. I think Paul Ehrlich put it the best when he said that it's just like people saying, well, we're in the bow of the boat, so it doesn't matter if the stern's sinking because we're still above water. And I don't think that we can continue to be have 1/6 of the world's population and consume upwards of 50% of the world's goods. And that's what we're doing, and we're rapidly depleting the world's resources with our high standard of living. And people say that you can't change people's habits. You hear people say, the gas and electric company will tell you that the consumption of electric power is doubling every 10 years. Well, the population even isn't doubling every 10 years. The reason it's doubling every 10 years, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They want it to double. They keep on inventing more gadgets. They push more air conditioning on you. You go into stores or buildings at this time of year when the temperature outside is 70 or 71, it's supposed to be the ideal temperature in winter, and you're nearly blasted with the cold air that comes at you from these air conditioners. They run the air conditioners full tilt regardless of whether there's any need for them or not. And I complain every place I go into when it's freezing cold, unnecessarily cold, with my loud foghorn voice, I say this is perfectly ridiculous. They're using consuming power for no reason. It's been estimated that our fossil fuels will be exhausted by the year 2000. So then people love to tell you that we can turn to nuclear fuel. Well, indeed, so we can, and that will heat up the Chesapeake Bay and other bodies of water and pollute our streams with radioactive materials. But people who are determined to make money will find an excuse for anything. And also people who are determined to indulge themselves. I go to town on the bus all the time, and I preach at everybody else, you don't need to drive the car to town. And the parking fees are so terrible. Don't get me started on the parking garages. I think that's the biggest steal from the taxpayers I've ever known. I said that years and years ago, that the idea that we should subsidize, the city taxpayers should help people like Har Wynn to buy parking lots to make mints of money at our expense while they charge us huge parking fees. It's the worst betrayal of the public trust that I can imagine. At any rate, apart from what you save by not taking the car to town, you're not polluting the atmosphere, at least. I've just gone on a transportation committee for the Citizens Planning and Housing Association, and I've undertaken to explore just what is supposed to be the emissions from automobiles. It was mostly in the morning paper. I've got a book there called Vanishing Air that's full of it. And that book also tells that about the Rankine cycle engine that's been developed that's possible to drive a car without any pollution at all. But of course, the oil companies don't want it. That would stop them selling gasoline. But the fact is that at this stage of history, it's interesting that you're putting this on an historical society tape. If there's anybody alive to read it in 20 years, they'll say, oh dear, if only somebody had paid attention back there in 1971 to the fact that we're polluting this planet at a ghastly rate. I mean, you can look around you now and see the quality of life is being destroyed. That there are too many automobiles, too many highways, and too much electricity, too much of everything that's artificial, and too little concern for nature and conservation. And though people are becoming aware of it, I don't feel that they have much influence on it. Mr. Bill Ruckelhaus makes a statement every day about, in the paper, about what he's going to do to cut down on pollution, but I don't see how he's going to be able to enforce it. This business about that beginning today that a car may not have any visible emissions, or he'll get a warning and then he'll be arrested or fined or something. Well, how many cars are they going to get? How many cars are they going to stop? They can't even tag the cars that park or tag the cars that speed or anything else. How they're going to pick up every car that's emitting pollutants, I'm sure I don't know. It's enforcement in every single one of these things that as long as the people won't cooperate, I can remember prohibition times when my fathers used to say that you cannot enforce a law that people are not in sympathy with. If the people want to drive their cars unhindered, they're going to do it. Whether we can stop the highways, I don't know. I have a button now that says stop the road, and people say, what road? And I say, any road. We don't need any more roads. The more roads you have, the more automobiles you have, and the more it pollutes the air. And my husband said to me the other day, well, let's face it, you can't blame the gas and electric company. You have to have more power. I said, why do we have to have more power? We live a whole month of the year in Canada in our camp in the woods without any power at all. We don't have any electric connection or any of any kind. We live perfectly happily without power. It's just a question of changing your point of view and your value system. Well, of course it's hard to sell it. It's hard to sell it. I used to, for 10 or 15 years, I've been talking about founding a national organization called STEPAC, the Society to Exalt People Above Cars. A man named Chermayev came to the museum about 10 years ago and gave a talk on the environment, and he said that the two enemies of American civilization were the automobile and noise. And he showed slides of the countries at that time. It was fully 10 years ago. At that time, Los Angeles was 65% paved, and he said that our cities were rapidly becoming parking lots, and that there wouldn't be any oxygen because there wasn't any greenery to give off any oxygen. And I went up to him afterward and I said, you're going to be the president of my national organization. And I explained it to him that I wanted to found STEPAC, and he said, no, I'm not, because he said, what you want to do is found an anti-automobile lobby. And I said, that's right. And he said, you can't do that, because the American people are in love with their automobiles. They care more for their automobiles than they do for their homes or their families. and they are not going to brook any opposition to their use of their automobiles. So I thought that was pretty discouraging. And he said, what's more, any politician that tries to interfere with the use of the automobile is going to be defeated because this is what the American people want to do. Well, if they want to, you know, be strangled by a hunk of metal that is of man's own creation, this seems to me the ultimate idiocy. But if we can't modify our life so that we don't let the automobile dominate our whole country, this is really what is happening to us now. We're paving the whole United States to accommodate the automobile. And you can't accommodate it anyway. You cannot accommodate the automobile. This highway in front of my house is, when they started to build it, there were 18,000 vehicles a day. Now they're 24,000 vehicles a day or something like that. And in another couple of years, it'll be just as crowded as it was before. And as Paul Sarbanes said during his campaign for Congress, when he defeated the head of the Board of Public Works, I'm proud to say, he said it doesn't matter if the traffic moves 5 miles an hour on Belvedere Avenue. This city has no right to take away taxable property, as poor as this city is, for the benefit of the automobile users. They'll just have to drive more slowly. That's all there is to it. There's no obligation on the part of the city or the state to accommodate automobiles at any particular rate of speed. And if they have to crawl along, they'll have to crawl along. Maybe they'll take to bicycles. But of course, as I say, he defeated George Fallon, who was the greatest exponent of road building that we've ever seen in the United States, and he was tremendously influential in the country, and was the highway lobby contributed huge sums to his campaign every year, and it was a miracle that Paul Sarbanes was able to defeat him. But what did he do when he went back for the lame duck session? He was a lame duck congressman. And he managed to get the highway trust funds extended for 5 more years, from 72 to 77. How he did it, I don't know. They weren't expiring till 72. There was no need for it, but it just showed how powerful he was. But that's politics for you. And now, the legislature has redistricted to take most of Paul Sarbanes' constituents away from him and put him in a different district, and Governor Mandel said he didn't know anything about it. He hadn't seen the plan. Most preposterous thing I ever heard, he hadn't seen the plan. It was designed to accommodate Mr. Garmatz and defeat Mr. Sarbanes, and this will be history, I hope, and by the time anybody ever hears this tape. But Paul Sarbanes is one of the ablest, most intelligent people we've ever sent to Congress, and if he's defeated by political gerrymandering, there are going to be a lot of very indignant people in this part of Baltimore, because we worked mighty hard to get him in there, and we didn't all plan to have him ousted by gerrymandering on the part of the governor. Maybe this is the part of the tape I should save, but I'm not going to save for future generations.
Well, it's interesting. Fact of life, I'm afraid.
Now, you spoke about, what did I think about urban renewal? That also ties in with the highways. The case of Rosemont is a dramatic one, case in point. They planned to run the East-West Expressway through Rosemont, and there was such a clamor on the part of the residents and the citizens who thought that it was the wrong place for it to be, and with some help, I guess, from the Greater Baltimore Committee, they managed to defeat it and get the route changed, but not after a lot of the properties had been condemned by the city. And they're now going to have to spend $5 million to restore Rosemont to what it was before they started to tear it down. And the thing about urban renewal, one of the things that makes it so difficult for Bob Embry to do his job, and incidentally, I think Bob Embry is one of the most intelligent and not to say brilliant, dedicated public servants we've ever had, the one who's now head of the Housing and Community Development Division of the city, but he is handicapped all the time by the fact that we're still in this state of indecision about where the East-West Expressway is going to go. Of course, as I say, the highway funds were supposed to stop at the end of 72, and some of us thought if we can keep on holding this off or keep the fight going on until 1972, why then we won't have to have it at all. But I guess we're going to have it. I don't know whether Governor Mandel said the other day, if they don't pass the ordinances that are necessary to complete the East-West Expressway through Baltimore City or around across the harbor, that he's going to spend the federal funds somewhere else so that we don't lose them, because the federal funds, so-called, are matching funds in which they put up $9 for every dollar that the city has to put up. And people think this is bonanza, that the money falls from the trees. Nobody ever realizes that the federal money comes out of our pockets, that we send more money to Washington than we get back. And because, contrary to most belief, Maryland is not one of those impoverished states that it's always saying it is. So that it isn't money growing on trees. It comes out of the taxpayer's pocket, no matter how much of the federal money is in it. And it's hard for the urban renewal people to go ahead and renew the city or get rid of the dilapidated parts of the city when they don't know where the condemnation is going to be, the roads or the schools or anything else. Now they have this so-called plan for joint development, which they say, and I put this down as say because I'll be interested if somebody hears this tape 20 years from now to find out if it ever happened, that the expressways are going to be beneficial to the neighborhoods that they run through because they can have auxiliary development, that they can maybe have overhead schools built on platforms above the expressway. It's going to be hard to study with the noise. It's like the roar of big waterfalls. And they can build shopping malls and residences along the expressway. I don't know who'd want to live in the residences, and I guess the shopping malls will have to be close to the outside world the way they are now. That's another one of my pet gripes, why they have to build these blind buildings with no windows and that in, from which you can get light or air. You're not using nature's light and air. You've got to use more that the gas and electric company produces for you. A tree fell down in Ruxton here last week, and all the lights were out all over Ruxton, and so the people were groping around in the market, which has virtually no outside light. And of course, the people in the beauty parlor were at a standstill. They came running out with their curlers and their pink nets on because all the dryers had gone bad on them. That's just a little bit of humor on your historical record. But I think that Bob Embry and his commission are making a valiant effort in the Gay Street section, in the Uptown section, and they've come around to the concept of trying to restore and trying to shore up old dwellings and not just tear everything down and build those high-rise projects, which we did for a while, and which have become a menace. They're not safe for children. Terrible things happen to them in the elevators, and they're really not viable living quarters, and except for older people without children. And so we're having to have a new concept of urban renewal, and we did just a few years ago. But the worst thing, of course, about urban renewal was that it was all directed at the cities. And by the same token, the worst thing about FHA was that they kept making loans to the people in the suburbs, and so they stimulated the white exodus to the suburbs, and they kept crowding more and more black and poor people into the city. And this has happened in every city in the country, and the federal government is as much responsible for it as anybody else. And now I heard just the other day that the people that want to get FHA mortgages for properties in the city are usually denied them because they say, well, that isn't a good risk. The FHA says that they're engaged in underwriting good risks, and that city property, by and large, isn't good risk. So they're just driving the city further and further into debt, because the people who want to live in the city and keep up the tax base are being discouraged from it. And of course, I'm still living here in the city. People that live in the county think we're absolutely crazy to live in the city. I have a friend who was instrumental in building this road. He was one of the engineers for it. He always says, what a lovely road I built in front of your house. I said, yes, so I can't sit on the porch. He lives in Sparks, Maryland, and tells me he gets to town in 25 minutes. Over what? Over roads that the taxpayers of Baltimore City are paying for. So,
I assume then that you're against the road near the Fort McHenry.
Yes, certainly I'm against all roads. I don't think we need any more roads to make it easy for the people that live in the county to come in and get into the city at large inconvenience and turn around and go back out to their green acres. Is Nine Horses the man that I speak of that lives way out in the county? And he comes into town and to his office over roads that were built by you and me. I don't know, you may live in the county too, for all I know, but the thing that interests me is how Indianapolis got a metropolitan government. Of course, this is what every city wants, is to try to annex the counties and the rich people. I was told the other day that Baltimore City only has 100,000 taxpayers left, that all the other people are tax exempt. This is how full the city is. Of course, some of them, lots of them are corporate taxpayers and large taxpayers. But I went to a meeting yesterday discussing rapid transit, and one of the men there very properly said, well, before we go into the best means of rapid transit, whether we want subways or old-fashioned railroads or whatnot, we'd better look into whether we want rapid transit at all. What is the future of Baltimore? Are there people who want to use the rapid transit to get into Baltimore? The county executive in Baltimore County says they have no need to go to Baltimore at all. They've got their own shopping centers and their own business and their own office buildings, and they can in Towson, and they don't need Baltimore City at all. This man said, we've got to look into what is the future of Baltimore City. Well, of course, you're concerned with the past of Baltimore City. Maybe it hasn't any future. Who knows? That'll be interesting to find out.
What do you think the chances are of getting a regional government?
Very poor indeed. I can't, that's just what I said. It fascinates me how I saw a young girl who goes to college in Indianapolis a few days ago, and I said, tell me, how did Indianapolis succeed in annexing all the surrounding counties? Well, she said, would you believe it? It's now the 12th city in the country. And imagine, little Indianapolis being the 12th largest city in the country. I said, well, I wouldn't think that would lure those suburban taxpayers into being included in the city and wanting to accept any of their responsibilities. And this is the plain fact here. Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County, Howard County, it doesn't make any difference. They don't want to be bothered with our problems. We've got all the problems. We've got the problems of crime and disease and the poor and the uneducated and everybody else, and they don't want to be bothered with it. They want to drive from their enclave into town, do their business, and go back out to the green countryside. And the politicians are not just before wanting to be running a citywide election. You could imagine what would happen to the county politicians in a city election after the way they've treated the people in the city. In fact, I understand that not numerically, but percentage-wise, there are fewer blacks in Baltimore County than there were 100 years ago. That the Baltimore County's been systematically pushing the black people back into the city by not giving them any place to live. And of course, they refuse to have urban renewal or a housing authority or any development that would benefit the low-income people, because they don't want the low-income people in the county. So the idea of being annexed to Baltimore City and taking on their problems of police and fire protection and education, all the expensive things that we have, I guess their education per capita is just as expensive as ours, isn't? They have a burgeoning school population. There isn't any question about that. But this is happening in every city in the country, practically. You have a black core and a shrinking tax base, and the county's becoming more populous and more affluent all the time. And now they're dominating the legislature so that you haven't got any chance in the state either. It used to be that the city had enough muscle in the state legislature to get some attention from the state, but now the populous counties dominate the state government, so you can't get any relief out of that. I don't know what's going to happen to the cities. Obviously, the mayors think the only thing that can happen to the city is that they get help direct from the federal government, and I think that's why most people that are really concerned about the cities are opposed to President Nixon's revenue sharing plan, because it would let the money siphon through the states, and you and I know perfectly well that plenty of state governors would siphon off a lot of money for subdivisions that didn't need it, and the best chance for the cities is to deal direct with the federal government, I think. But the cities are in a sad state. What with their traffic problems and their parking lots and their... We had a, this might interest you, we had a regional council of the League of Women Voters for a few years, and even it fell apart. They had so little in common, and each county was concerned with their own government and their own charter and their own elections and their own problems, and there really didn't seem any viable way to work on a regional level. We have a regional planning commission now, you know, but they have no power. They just have advisory, and the subdivisions don't pay any attention to them unless it suits the subdivisions. It's sort of like the sovereignty in the United Nations. Nobody will submerge their own interests for the greater good of the whole. Mm-hmm. And until we do, sometime we're going to find ourselves either choked to death by the population or in a nuclear war. They're the only two alternatives. You know, if the planet gets overpopulated, we'll just have, it'll be nature. We'll weed it out with famine, pestilence, and war, the four horsemen that have always taken over. Mm-hmm. And there's some new organization called Plain Survival. There's a new organization every day. But they're always the same people, ever since I've lived in Baltimore. And a lot of the people are as old as I am now, and they just change their hats and go somewhere else. I remember one day I met Guthrie Spears three times in one day, and I said, this is a joke, you know? We all the same people do everything. We just change our hats and go around and run different axes or support different causes. But I always love what Frank Burton, and then again, of course, they're by and large, they're not the Baltimoreans that are doing it, you know. The that thing that Frank Burton said in the Amiable Baltimoreans, I always loved, he said that in most cities, if you came from out of town and you came into the city of your adoption and started telling them how to run things, they'd say, well, you can go back where you came from. We'll run our own city, thank you. Not so in Baltimore. If you come from out of town and start telling them what to do about how to improve their city, they say, that's fine. Just roll up your sleeves and go to work. And then they go back out to the country and get on their horse and let the peasants do the work. And I've always thought that's the way the Baltimoreans regard us, people from out of town. That we're the peasants and we're supposed to do the work, and they're supposed to enjoy pleasant living in the land of pleasant living.